You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's been 100 years since women won the right to vote. We'll find out how that movement and others of the time worked together and sometimes clashed. Now, Wisconsin's K-12 student body has gotten more diverse in the last 10 years, with the share of students of colors in public schools having grown in cities, suburbs, and rural areas. The percentage of teachers of color in the state schools also went up, but hasn't kept pace with changes in student demographics. That's according to a new report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum, which analyzed data from 2009 through 2019. It looks at some of the reasons for the growing racial gap between students and teachers and why it matters for kids. Ann Chapman is a senior researcher with the Wisconsin Policy Forum. She's one of the authors of the report titled A Teacher Who Looks Like Me. Ann, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into the numbers, let's talk about why this is important. There's a growing body of research on diverse teaching staffs. What kind of results have we seen when students have more teachers from their own ethnic background?
Yes, correct. So one of the things that drove our motivation to do this research is the growing and or the persistent and large achievement gaps based on race and ethnicity that have been going on in Wisconsin for a long time. And then, as you said, we know that there's a growing body of research that says when a student has access to a teacher from their same race or ethnic background, they can experience a number of different benefits. And those range from gains in academic achievement, like higher test scores in math and reading, better student engagement, so higher attendance and lower rates of suspension and dropout. There are things that have to do with sort of the student-teacher relationship, where student motivation and academic behavior has been shown to be better. Things like higher teacher expectations of students' ability has been measured. And then in the longer term horizon, there have been studies that show that these students have higher GPAs, you know, better high school graduation rates, better enrollment in college, and even long-term outcomes like better rates of employment.
And so that's for children who are seeing teachers who look like them. But it also seems like more diversity potentially is beneficial to students of other races as well.
Absolutely. So when you look at sort of the benefits of a diverse teaching workforce in general for all students, and even if you talk about it in terms of a benefit for white students, there's other research and empirical and anecdotal evidence that says that, you know, when you think about the fact that we're training students to become workers and citizens in a multicultural society, it's important that the teachers and leaders that they experience during their K-12 education reflect the breadth of the society that they're going to be entering. And specifically for white students, there's been some writing that it's helpful for white students to have teachers of color throughout their K-12 experience to, you know, understand, and for all students, actually, white students and students of color, to see teachers of color in roles of leadership and responsibility and authority. And for white students to sort of have that image, because it may, you know, undermine some of the racial bias that they experience in their own communities or through the media.
We're talking with Ann Chapman from the Wisconsin Policy Forum right now about a new report about the impact of children of color not having teachers who look like them. It's called A Teacher Like Me. And Ann, let's get into the data that you looked at and start with the students. So during the 10-year period that you examined, what happened with the demographics of Wisconsin's K-12 students?
Sure. So we looked at enrollment in the K-12 system across the last 10 years for public school students. So these are students in traditional school districts and as well as charter schools. And about 10 years ago, K-12 students, about a quarter of them were students of color. And by the time we get to 2019, close to a third of them are students of color. But the proportion of teachers of color in that time only inched up a little bit, and teachers of color comprise a much smaller share of the total teachers. So throughout that 10-year period, teachers of color increased from 4.5% to just 5.6%. So what that tells us is that students of color are growing pretty pretty rapidly, but teachers of color are predominantly white. So about 95% of them have been white over the last decade. So when you think about that in terms of what we just talked about in terms of the benefits students of color can have from having a teacher from their same background, and you consider the fact that students of color are growing, you could think of that as, you know, a really valuable resource that is in short supply, that calls some attention.
And when you look at specific racial and ethnic groups, are there some groups where the gap is even larger than for other groups?
Yes. Yeah, so we looked specifically at some of the trends for Black teachers and students and Hispanic teachers and students, because those are the two race ethnic groups that are the largest students of color in the state. For Black students, what we see is a slight decline in the percentage of students who are Black, just about 1.1 percentage points. So Black students make up about 9% of all the students in the state. And so the gap between Black and white, Black students and Black teachers has narrowed a little bit over the last 10 years. On the other hand, for Hispanic students is what's driving the growth in students of color overall across the state. They have grown from 8% to 12% over the last 10 years. And so the gap between Hispanic teachers make up about 2% of all teachers. So that gap has widened.
One of the interesting things that I found in reading the report is that you can't just look at those numbers. First of all, you can't just look at teachers of color, students of color, because as you said, there are very different numbers depending on which demographic group you might be looking at. But then when you look at something like Native American students and Native American teachers, there might be a Native American teacher teaching Native American kids, but they may come from a tribe that has extremely different language, cultural, historical contexts.
Yes, I think the Native American picture, it deserves almost its own deeper dive, because, you know, in our study, what you see across the state is that there is a gap between Native American students and Native American teachers, but, you know, spread across the state on average, it doesn't look that big compared to the gaps for Black and Hispanic students. But if you look at the actual districts where Native American students go, the percentage of Native American students is really high in those districts. In other words, they're concentrated in just a few districts for the most part. And the teaching staff of those schools is very white. And so the gaps in the districts where most of those students go are very wide. And like you say, they get a little bit even below that. Native American is a broad term. And so you've got students from very different cultural backgrounds. And so that just exacerbates the student-teacher gap problem.
And it's probably not quite as severe, but I'm guessing that also happens with the Latinx Hispanic grouping as well, because it could be kids or teachers from, say, Mexico or Nicaragua or Paraguay, and they might all speak Spanish, but they have a very different context.
Absolutely. So, yeah, this is sort of looking at this from a pretty broad, you know, bird's eye view. But if you think, you know, you can almost think of having a teacher of your own race or ethnic background as kind of a proxy for a teacher who's had your same life experience. And so, yeah, you can dig a little bit deeper and see that what really matters is a similar life experience, right?
I think some people might assume that this is a Milwaukee or Madison issue primarily, but your research found that suburban and rural areas are seeing this as well. Is it as significant?
Correct. So, yeah, that was an interesting finding. We also compared gaps across cities, suburbs, towns, and rural areas between 2009 and 2019. And what you find, you may expect to find, and we did find, that the largest gap is between students and teachers in cities. And that's somewhat not surprising, just because that's where we find most of the students of color, but also most of the teachers of color. But because the students of color are so numerous in cities, the gaps are pretty wide. But when you look at the gaps in suburbs, towns, and rural areas, you see that they're significant across both years, but they're growing at a faster rate in terms of percentage in the suburbs, towns, and rural areas than they are in cities. So this is an issue, and we also in our report have a map that shows there's about 17 districts that have a majority students of color in their K-12 districts. And in those districts, the student-teacher race gaps are no less than 40 percentage points. And the way those 17 school districts are distributed across the state is very wide. It kind of goes all the way from north to south and all the way from east to west. They're kind of scattered throughout the state. And so what this tells us is that this is a statewide issue, and it affects different districts in different ways. But this is something that, deserves attention in many different parts of the state.
And briefly, before we let you go, Anne, Wisconsin, unfortunately, has been known for years for the achievement gap between students of color and white students. Many fewer students of color, especially African-American, graduating from high school, which, of course, is a prerequisite to get a college degree, which is a prerequisite to teach. Other than addressing the achievement gap, which has been tried for many years, are there other concrete steps that we should be taking to try to get more teachers of color into the classroom?
Yes. Well, you basically teed it up there. You know, our conclusion, is that we did look upstream in the teacher pipeline at some of the differences by race in the milestones that are needed to be able to join the teaching workforce. So we looked at differences in race in high school graduation, enrollment in college, and enrollment in teacher prep programs. And on the optimistic side, we saw that students of color as a percent of all students are going up over the 10 years in those three areas. But there's a drop off from each educational step to the next, so that we basically see a narrowing of potential teachers of color as they go down the educational pathway. And what that tells us, though, is that at each of those points, there are opportunities for policy interventions that could potentially help, more kids graduate from high school, enroll in college, and go to teacher prep programs.
Well, Anne, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Anne Chapman is a senior researcher at the Wisconsin Policy Forum. She joined us to talk about a new report showing that the gap between the percentage of teachers and students of color grew wider over the last decade. Coming up, do you type one or two spaces after a period? Our grammar expert weighs in and explains why she says the matter will eventually be settled. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, we'll dive into the very hot debate over how many spaces we should type after a period. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a food tradition involving fish.
People have been fishing the Mississippi River for about 1,000 years. It's a tradition that's passed down through families for survival and recreation. Mike Valley is part of that tradition and one of the last people to still make a living as a commercial fisherman on the Upper Mississippi. And when he gets his catch, he often smokes it. WPR's Mary Kate McCoy hopped on Valley's boat to learn more about his smoked fish and his love of the river.
There are few fishermen like Mike Valley left on the Mississippi River.
The millions of pounds of fish that I've caught, it's still peace and tranquility for me out here. It is a lost art. It's a dying art. Like sitting here right now, I mean, this is just absolutely beautiful to me. To get out of that phone ringing, people knocking all day, every day, it's just like, ah.
Valley is a third-generation fisherman. The work is in his blood. He's owned Valley Fish and Cheese in Prairie du Chien since the 1980s. He grew up hunting, trapping, clamming, and working with his father. His dad also had a shop on the river and sold his fish to markets in Chicago, New York, and Boston. But as the fishing industry changed, Valley knew the only way he was going to survive was by forging his own path. Sell quality, fresh fish and products that you can't find anywhere else.
I've always said, you'll never have anyone come into my shop and then leave and then go home and tell all their friends and their relatives, this guy had beef jerky. Or, oh my God, he had Colby cheese. No, he had snapping turtle jerky, he had alligator jerky, catfish bologna, the weird things.
Valley is particular. Years of fishing and smoking his catch have taught him that you can't cut corners if you want to stand out. Even though he's caught millions of pounds of fish, the novelty hasn't worn off.
I still really, truly enjoy catching fish. The cleaning, not so much. But that's part of the job. Everybody that I take with me always, they're like, oh my God, this is so fun. This is really great. And then you get back and they go, see ya.
So. Valley cleans the fish, typically catfish, carp, buffalo, and sturgeon, up to 4 times. Then he brines it for at least half a day. Details matter. Not all fish are the same, and they shouldn't be treated the same, he says. The thicker the fish, the more salt you're going to need. And each fish gets its own brine with different seasonings that bring out its flavors. Then Valley puts the fish in the smoker, which he claims is the only licensed 100% wood smoker left in the state.
We light it with wood, it ends with wood. No liquid smoke, no gas, no nothing. And that is huge. It makes a world of difference. Basically, we're all hickory. Well, once in a while, we'll burn a little apple wood.
And it can't be rushed. Patience is key. Valley could finish the fish in an hour, but he prefers to give it 10 to 12 hours to really soak up the smoky flavor.
I relate it to a sponge. If you just barely hold it on the water, just missed it, it sucks it in and takes time. So that's what you want to do with the fish. You want to very slowly permeate it and bring it up to temp. You know, otherwise, if you just cook it, it's just a cooked piece of fish. It isn't smoked. 1734.
Valley jokes about a law he has at Valley Fish and Cheese when customers make a modest purchase. Once you buy it and leave the door, you can't come back in and buy more.
I will literally, honestly, hear 10 times a day, this is unbelievable smoked fish. Well, you know, it is. Because it was swimming yesterday and it's smoked today. It's to die for.
Yet all that being said, Valley says you don't necessarily need to head over to the Mississippi and catch the fish yourself. He recommends finding a nice piece of salmon or fish of your choice and practicing a little patience.
WPR's Mary Kate McCoy brought us that story on Mike Valley's smoked fish. And this story is part of a project from Wisconsin Life called Food Traditions. It's a multimedia exploration of food, culture, and identity, and can be found at wisconsinlife.org/foodtraditions. And we want to hear about your own food traditions. Share them with us on Instagram. Just search for Wisconsin Life. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, when you're typing and you finish a sentence, do you space once or twice before starting the next one? People feel very strongly about it. We got over 60 comments on Facebook. You can check those out. The Two Space Camp says the extra gap makes the text easier to read. Among that crowd includes legal professionals who have to sift through long documents that are loaded with citations. But to quote a 19-year-old one-spacer in the Wall Street Journal, two spaces look ridiculous. Our guest says this will likely get hashed out over the years ahead. You double spacers, and I used to be a pretty committed one, may not like what you're going to hear. Mignon Fogarty, a.k.a. Grammar Girl, is the founder of the Quick and Dirty Tips Network. She's the author of Grammar Girl's Quick and Dirty Tips for Better Writing and other books about grammar. Mignon, thanks for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me. What you found is not surprising. On your Facebook page, people have a surprising amount of passion about this topic.
Well, and you know, as public media journalists, we're very committed to transparency and openness. So I do have to ask you, are you a single or double spacer?
Oh, definitely a single spacer, even though I learned to type two spaces in typing class in high school. So I don't believe people who say they were taught and they just can't change.
Okay, because that is a big argument, right? That this is generational, that those of us that actually typed on typewriters in our beginning years of school, college, maybe even our careers, that was what we were told. And, you know, by golly, we're going to stick with it. But there are people that have converted, whether willingly or not. So what do you attribute the passion to if this is not something that can't be unlearned? And we learn to do other things. So it seems like this is interesting that people get so riled up about it.
Right. Don't sell yourself short. You can change. It's a great question, though. And I actually don't know why people are so committed to whatever it is they do. I think, you know, I see this when I encounter people who've learned English as a second language, and they tend to be more rigid about the rules of English than native English speakers. I think that when we work hard to learn a rule or a rule of grammar, whether it's typing or grammar, that we feel more committed to it because we worked so hard to learn it. So, you know, maybe for people, if typing was difficult for them or they didn't enjoy typing class and had it drilled into their head to do it this way and only this way, they feel committed to that rule because it was such a chore to learn it. That's one theory.
So there are Facebook comments that we had. Janice says, my daughter proofreads a lot of things in her work. She says one of the biggest things she corrects is two spaces to one after the period. This makes more words per page and can ultimately save a little paper. I'm not sure that's that convincing to me, that a bunch of single spaces being taken out is going to make that much of a difference. But Leanne says one space, they don't teach two anymore, and it makes everything look disjointed. Plus, it leaves room for inconsistencies within the workplace. I think a lot of people would agree that consistency is important. Katina says, I used to do two because that's how I was taught on a typewriter. One day, a younger colleague explained it made me appear old. That stopped me. And Central Time producer Bill Martin said, I used to be a two-spacer just because that's how I was taught. Then the web editors at WPR told me to knock it off. It only took me a couple of days to break the habit. Now it annoys me when I see two spaces. So Bill being the example of, the worst advocate is the recent convert. But there are reasons why we used to do two spaces after a period. What were those and why are those not useful anymore?
Yes, it's fascinating. Actually, if you look more than 100 years ago, there actually were three spaces after a period. Was the norm. And then around the turn of the century, that's when it was three spaces. And then around 1925, the Chicago Manual of Style essentially said one and a half spaces. And then it was 1950 when Chicago said to use one space. So, and today, all the major style guides say to put one space after the period. So in a professional setting, anywhere that you're following, a professional style, you really should only be putting one space after the period. So the style guides now sort of all agree, but more than 100 years ago, it was even more complicated when people were doing, typesetting with metal type. There were different amounts of space that they would put after different punctuation marks. So it was, I think, more after a semicolon than a comma. And it was very complex. And like many things, over time, as it became more efficient, things just got more standardized. So now it's just...
We'll have to leave it there, Mignon. Mignon Fogarty joined us to talk about two spaces or one after a period. Coming up, we'll talk about suffrage. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson in for Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 7 on the morning show, the coronavirus pandemic temporarily shut down Wisconsin's casinos. Many are run by the state's 11 federally recognized tribal nations, and gaming revenue can make up a sizable portion of tribal government budgets. Kate Archer Kent speaks with the president of the Ho-Chunk Nation about the impacts of the deficit. That's tomorrow after 7. Now, 100 years ago, this short paragraph changed history. The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. Congress shall have power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. 2020 marks a century since women got the right to vote in the United States. It was a long, contentious, and often dirty battle that spanned the country and both united and divided reformers and activists for different causes. Ellen Du Bois is Distinguished Research Professor at UCLA, where she taught women's history. She's the co-editor of the anthology Unequal Sisters, A Multicultural Reader in Women's History, and co-author of Through Women's Eyes, An American History with Documents. Her most recent book is Suffrage, Women's Long Battle for the Vote. Ellen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, I'm so excited. This is great.
Well, the subtitle of your book is Women's Long Battle for the Vote. Both long and battle really come out in the story you paint. It's such a rich history, but can you briefly set the stage of the early women's suffrage movement in the mid-19th century?
So the sort of generally accepted date of the beginning of the movement is 1848, which was one of those world historic years. It was the end of the Mexican War. It was the revolutions, the European revolutions that were democratic revolutions. It was the accession of northern Mexico to the United States. And it was the beginning of one of the major, one of the efforts at building a political party that was, hold on, let me turn this off here. That was one of the first attempts to create a political party that took slavery into national politics. That process eventually created the Republican Party, a distant relative of our current Republican Party. So it occurred in upstate New York in an area that was once called the Burned Over District, not because of forest fires, but because of the sweeping of evangelical crusades, which preceded a series of reform movements. This wasn't really true of the women's suffrage movement, but the anti-slavery movement, which preceded it, was very, very religious in its origins, as was the temperance movement. So I think that's enough for a setting.
Well, so as you said, 1848, this was when the Seneca Falls Convention was called. It is often pointed to as the start of the suffrage movement, where women who were involved in other social movements took on the cause of getting the right to vote given to women in the United States. And as you mentioned, the anti-slavery movement was active at the same time the issue of abolition was coming to a head. What were some of the principles and some of the people that both the suffrage movement and the abolition movement shared?
Well, let me clarify a little. That movement began in 1848 was a women's rights movement. Suffrage was one of the issues, but it wasn't the primary issue. It wasn't really until the immediate aftermath of the Civil War, which I think we'll probably get to talk about, that suffrage rose to the top. I guess what you would say anti-slavery and women's rights had in common was a philosophy of universal human rights, as some of its initiators used to say, that it was that human beings, regardless of the accidents of skin, which is how they incorporated both gender and race, human beings had common rights and equal civil rights and ultimately equal political rights. This was both an issue of the Enlightenment notion of universal humanity, but also of a kind of radical Christianity, which argued strongly that all human beings were equal in the sight of God.
And as you said, the Civil War came, and in the aftermath of the Civil War, there was a movement to provide the right to vote to Black men, to recently freed slaves who were men. Black women were not included in that, and white women were not included in that effort. Tell us about the dynamics of that period when white women and women of color, freed women of color, who had been part of this women's rights movement, saw that the vote was going to go to Black men before it went to them.
So let's note one of the things that happened when the 15th Amendment, which ultimately protected the right of Black men to vote, came into the Constitution. Prior to that, there had been no effort to use the United States Constitution to assert the right of anybody to vote. The right to all people to vote was located in the states, which I might point out it still is. So the 15th Amendment did something new. It introduced the question of who got the right to vote into the United States Constitution. There had been an effort at that time, an original effort this is so important, to link the right to vote to national citizenship. And that would have made it unnecessary either to specify race or gender. Unfortunately, that failed. You read the 15th Amendment, and it doesn't say anything. It doesn't assert the right to vote. It just says that certain people, in this case, people can't be denied the right to vote by virtue of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. When that formulation of the 15th Amendment, which was going to sort of finish the business of the post-Civil War years, when it came forward and was ratified, some, not all of the leaders of the women's suffrage movement, the women's rights movement, which was now focusing on suffrage, made the fateful decision to oppose the ratification of the 15th Amendment on the grounds that, as Elizabeth Cady Stanton said, the constitutional door would slam shut. And let's note that it did. The 15th Amendment was ratified in 1870. The next time a constitutional amendment was ratified, the 16th, was in the early 20th century. So there was a kind of desperation to get women's right to vote into the Constitution. And I really appreciate your pointing out that the 15th Amendment doesn't protect the right of Black people to vote. It protects the right of Black men to vote.
So, Ellen, what were some of the arguments against women having the right to vote?
Well, it depends on when. If you start in this early mid-19th century period, the kinds of arguments are that women do not have either the abilities to reason, the political knowledge, or the independence of judgment that were required of voters. By the early 20th century, those arguments are pretty outdated. Then we switch to notions that women don't really want the vote, that the kind of people who are going to vote are bad women. You might imagine what that might mean. Or in the South, Black women, horrors. Also that women make their contribution to the national good by raising their by protecting their families and raising their children, especially their sons, and that it's almost as if the right to vote was a right for a family rather than an individual, so that the husband and father represented the family. Of course, that's not how we think of the right to vote, not even from the beginning of our nation. It was always an individual right.
And what kind of smears, you've kind of referred to them a little bit, what kind of specific attacks did some of the prominent suffragists face?
Well, if we are in the 19th century still, and we look at the woman who eventually became the most prominent suffragist, Susan B. Anthony, she was mercilessly portrayed visually in cartoons as a as a mannish woman, an extremely unattractive woman. It's almost a way to frighten other women from going to try and get the vote because they will appear to be unattractive, asexual, unfeminine, and that wanting to get the right to vote will deprive them of the love of men, of the right to have children. It's interesting. Anthony never married, but her partner in crimes, Elizabeth Stanton, was married, had a marriage that that continued for, I'm not sure how long, 40 or 50 years, and who had, wait for it, 7 children. Amazingly, she was a very healthy woman. Every one of her children not only survived birth, but lived into a ripe old age. And that didn't really happen to most women in the 19th century.
Another social movement that involved many suffrage activists and many women in general was the temperance movement against alcohol, against alcoholism. Why was that such a priority for so many women?
So, yes, in the 19th century, especially once slavery was ended, the issue that was most deeply connected with women's right to vote was the temperance issue, which was not quite the same as prohibition. It was an effort to get people to convince them not to drink, and particularly to convince men not to drink. The argument being that when men and then alcoholism and excessive use of alcohol was associated with men, they drank up the money that should have gone to their families. And perhaps most importantly, the alcohol abuse was associated, the alcoholism was associated with domestic abuse, with wife beating and child beating. This is an association which shouldn't be foreign to us completely now. Substance abuse and violence, and especially, I must say, male violence are closely associated. So the notion here was that if women wanted to protect, this was a brilliant shift that was made by the head of the women's temperance movement, a woman named Frances Willard, who was born in Wisconsin, I think, or she moved to Wisconsin from Michigan, something like that, was that if women wanted to protect their families, they had to leave their families to protect their families. They had to go into politics. They had to pass laws. And the anti-alcohol laws, people in the Midwest will probably, of a certain age, will know this. The anti-alcohol laws were usually local laws. They were called local option. So one town would forbid the sale of alcohol, and then maybe the town over would not. But the argument was that women needed the right to enter to politics, first to protect against the sale of what was often called king alcohol, king liquor. And then in the 20th century, the same kind of argument, women needed to leave the home so that they could help pass laws to protect the quality of milk so that, you know, the milk they bought in stores was healthy. We take for granted the fact that the milk we buy in stores is regulated as to its safety.
We're talking with Ellen Dubois right now about her new book, Suffrage, Women's Long Battle for the Vote. She's a distinguished research professor at UCLA, where she taught women's history. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Were you taught about the suffrage movement in school? What do you think of the strategies that the factions chose? And do you think an acceptance of black men getting the vote before women was strictly political, or did it say something about the culture's views of women? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're continuing our conversation with Ellen Dubois right now. We're talking about her book, Suffrage, Women's Long Battle for the Vote. And Ellen, there were not just the upper class white women who are often portrayed as kind of icons of the suffrage movement. There were also men, and there were also women and men of color. Can you briefly tell us about some of those other characters?
Yes. Let's start with women and men of color. From the very beginning, there are African-American women who are supporters of women's right to vote. The most famous of these in the early years is Sojourner Truth. At the time of the 15th Amendment, some black women went with the argument that black men should get the vote if that's all that could happen. And others, to quote Sojourner Truth, would say, we should go for the whole loaf. We should keep the whole thing going. The other, another great African-American figure, and the man who supported woman suffrage most consistently in the 19th century was Frederick Douglass, the great free slave, former slave, and spokesperson of equality. In the 20th century, the number of African-American women increases, but it's also the case that, especially in national politics, under the Woodrow Wilson administration, which was rigidly segregationist, as we're now learning, African-American women had no chance to be part of national politics. They were, however, part of politics at the state level in places like New York or Illinois or probably Wisconsin for that matter. I also want to say that in the 20th century, the class character of among white women changes in the suffrage movement, and we get really substantial numbers, thousands upon thousands of wage-earning women, most of whom are first-generation European immigrants.
Let's go to the phones, and Barbara in Marquette County is up. Hi, Barbara.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I'd like to talk a little bit about Thomas Paine, and in 1775, way back then, he talked about our country, that we should end slavery. And he also talked about equality for women in editorials that he wrote for the newspaper that was owned by Benjamin Franklin. And I think this struggle has been going on for a long time, and it keeps getting pushed back.
Thanks for that call, Barbara. And Ellen, you talk about Thomas Paine also in your book.
Well, it's a good point. But I guess I would say that what my book is about and what the history of suffrage is about is not individuals making that call, but the creation and the sustaining of a women-led political movement. And that's what begins in 1848. It begins with a public meeting, which was then called a convention. And from then on, we have consistent callings of public meetings, petitioning, submission of amendments to constitutions. So what we have is what we could call the beginning of a movement.
And Ellen, briefly, because we're almost out of time, here we are 100 years later. What do you think the suffragists would have said about this moment in our country's history?
Well, when I first started writing this book, I thought, oh, great, we'll have a woman president. And that will be, you know, the other shoe dropping, not happening. So I would say that what I think the suffragists would say is that they stubbornly continued for 75 years, and they would have continued for another 75 if they'd had to. And that is what is incumbent upon us. We cannot, because we get set back or our opponents have greater resources than we do, or their ridicule and attacks on us are insufferable. We cannot give up. We just keep on keeping on the way they did.
Well, Ellen, thank you so much for being with us today.
It was great.
Ellen Du Bois is a distinguished research professor at UCLA, where she taught women's history. She was with us to discuss her most recent book. It's titled Suffrage, Women's Long Battle for the Vote. 2020 marks the 100-year anniversary of women's suffrage in the United States. And coming up, hopefully in the following months, we will get to talk more specifically about the Wisconsin experience. You may or may not know that Wisconsin was actually the first state that ratified the 19th Amendment, which gave women the vote. There's a fun story there. And there were some very prominent women who were either born or lived in Wisconsin who contributed to the national suffrage movement. Well, coming up tomorrow on Central Time, with a surge in the number of positive COVID-19 cases, some states are requiring people to wear face masks in public, but not Wisconsin. We'll look at the authority that officials here have when it comes to preventing new outbreaks, and we'll ask what you'd like to see done. Milwaukee was once one of the best cities in the country for Black people. Today, it's one of the worst. We'll talk with a journalist and Milwaukee native about the frustrating lack of progress and what other cities are doing to boost opportunities for their Black residents. And we'll talk to friends who met as young people in Madison who went on to create a small publishing press focusing on comics by and for queer people. They also hope to increase representation of people of color. That's tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show. Tomorrow after 6, just to add to the weird sense of time many of us are experiencing this year, the extended deadline for submitting your state and federal tax returns is July 15th. With that date approaching, a tax professional from Green Bay joins host Kate Archer-Kent to share tips on organizing documents, filing electronically, reporting income and deductions. That's tomorrow morning after 6, right here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR. And then the mayor of Green Bay joins us to talk about a new program the city is creating that would create jobs for the unemployed and cross off some long overdue parks projects. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. In for Rob Ferret, this is Central Time.